Welcome, listeners, to a brand new episode of Oh My Word, bonus episode of Oh My Word podcast. Amazing special treat we have today is we've got an agent. Yes, one of those weird unicorns. We've captured him and we have him for an interview today. Everyone, Alec Shane from The Writer's House. Alec, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here. I appreciate you having me.
I feel like for writers, agents are like the, oh, you know, the angelic with the halo and, you know, aura kind of situation. So we're so glad that you're here.
Yeah, it's funny. I personally never quite understood why authors hold agents in such high regard when it should be the exact opposite. You know, if authors stopped writing, agents would be unemployed immediately. But if agents disappeared, writers would still keep on writing. So it should be the halo should be on the writer's head, not our head. So hopefully I can debunk that myth during today's interview.
You know what? I almost feel like we could just cut it right there and that's turn that into like a magnet and we're done.
All right.
So how did you get into agenting? Why you're like, you know what? I'm going to be an agent. Like, why would you decide that?
Yeah, good question. And I did, honestly. I'll keep it as short as possible. Basically, I moved to New York in June of 2008 after a short and unsuccessful but very fun career in the stunt industry in Los Angeles, doing a lot of really bad straight-to-DVD action movies, you know, where the good guy beat up like seven dudes at once. I played like dude number three or dude number four in a couple of bargain bin bad action movies. But stunt work is not a very long career because you're getting beat up for a living. You can't do it forever. And I've always been an East Coast kid, lived in Connecticut my whole life. And I moved to New York, not because I was really excited about it, but I had nothing else to do, and I thought, you know, I'll give finance a try. I hear they make good money. But June 2008 was also literally the month when the bubble burst, the economy collapsed, and everything kind of went to pot in the finance industry.
Yeah.
So any job that any hedge fund or investment firm, whatever, that survived the bubble bursting wasn't hiring. The very few that were hiring were not looking for a 27-year-old stuntman. So I was like, well, I guess finance is out. What do you like to do, Alec? You got to find a job. New York's not a cheap place to live. I'm a huge sports fan. There's a lot of sports teams in New York, NFL offices in New York. I like to read. I knew books was a job in some capacity. I knew they were written by authors and put on shelves by bookstore employees. Something had to have happened between those two things on the book end of the spectrum. So I literally just Googled the word book jobs one day and started kind of navigating the weird internet maze of finding people who worked in the industry and making cold calls and emails and all that junk, and ended up literally cold calling Writer's House. And I basically just spoke to the Michael Mejias, who kind of runs the internship program there, and I sweet-talked my way into, I believe, a informational interview, they call it, and I was able to get an internship that fall. And I was luckily in that right place, right time. Jody Reamer, who's a very successful agent, represents Twilight, represents John Green, Ryan some Riggs, a lot of very successful YA titles, was looking for an assistant as I was finishing my program up. And so I started working for her in 2009. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. When I hear of cold calling these days, I think of the person on the other end of the phone saying, oh, thank you for your interest. But no, you know, that.
Yeah. I mean, it's not that far. Basically, I called Michael and I was like, hey, listen, you don't know me. I'm looking to get into publishing. Are you hiring? This is in 2008, so it wasn't as maybe weird as it is today versus the text message and DMs. But he laughed. But he, I guess, it admired my moxie. And he's also a Yankees fan. I'm a Red Sox fan. We kind of bonded over the rivalry a little bit. And we kind of hit it off. And so I got very lucky in that respect. But yeah, I mean, it's not something I don't know if it really works today, cold calls. But You miss all the shots you don't take, as Wayne Gretzky used to say.
Right. I have to ask something about the stuntman thing. How do you fall into something like that? Like, oh, I can take a punch, or like I could get thrown around, or I'm good at gymnastics, or I'm good at, I don't know, like what? Why would someone, like, how do you even do that?
Yeah, a good question. I have been training in martial arts since I was about 6 years old. And so that's kind of where it came from, the thought process. Well, I actually went to school to be a teacher. And I still might be a teacher. I think it's a cool retirement job. Teach creative writing at some prep school somewhere, some school off in the Midwest, just kind of keep yourself busy. But I did my student teaching in Central Falls, Rhode Island, which is a lower economic status area in Providence, primarily a Guatemalan and Puerto Rican population. And I absolutely love the kids. I love the environment. But when you're immigrating to America at age 12 or 13 or so, not speaking any English at all,
right,
sometimes you're held back a year or two as you acclimate, learn the language, get accustomed to the society, whatever the case may be. And I was 23, teaching 19 and 20 year old kids. And when you're 23 and your students are 20, yeah. like, it's not no one's fault, but there isn't like an age gap that is required for a teacher and a student. Right. They got along. They were very respectful. They were wonderful kids. But again, they just didn't see me as a teacher through nobody's fault. So it's like, all right, well, teaching's fun. I enjoy it. I like these kids, like the environment. I got to get a little older. 27 or 28 is ancient to a 20-year-old. So yeah. I can go back at like 27. I know martial arts. I've been doing it for a long time. I had a couple friends in L.A. I'll move out there. If I become the next Jackie Chan, awesome. If I don't, no big deal. I'll go back and start teaching, which was initially the intention at some point, but I just fell into publishing it and loved it so much. I haven't really thought about it since.
Wow. Did you grow up as a big reader, or were you always reading just sports stats, or was that what Brooks always part of your life? It was just like, oh yeah, I also like that also.
Yeah, no, I was always a big reader. My mother always had a Stephen King book in her hands. And one of my more enjoyable childhood memories was I come home from school, like first grade, kindergarten, whatever, and she'd make me a snack and she'd kind of tell me what was happening in the book she was reading. She'd obviously kind of PG-ify it for kids.
Yeah.
And left out the gory parts. Like, I fell in love with kind of horror stories and Stephen King. I was listening to my mom kind of give book reports on the book that she was reading. And I read through all the Goosebumps books and all the Three Investigators and the Choose Your Own Adventure books. And I've been reading for a very, very long time. Sports stats, of course, as well. But, you know, my mom and I always bonded over books. And so she's definitely the one I'm blaming for my career choice.
Yeah, because also becoming an agent, I'm thinking, like, for a lot of people, you tell them, oh, I'm going to be a writer or I am a writer, they kind of give you the look of, like, you know, when are you going to get a real job? So do you get that as an agent? Because it's so commission-based, right? I think it's all commission-based, right? So do you kind of get that look of, oh, are you ever going to get a real job? Or people don't see agents in that same kind of way?
Yeah, it's funny. People don't really know what agents do in publishing. Everyone knows about their Hollywood agent or their sports agent. But
right.
If you're, like, literary agent, no one's like, oh, I know what that is.
Right.
You know, it's. I mean, I think there are a lot of sales jobs that are commission only, and I like the fact that you reap what you sow. You know, you get out what you put in.
Yeah,
there's a nice kind of freedom to that. Obviously, there's a lot of pressure in that because if you don't sell anything, you don't make any money.
Right.
But you know, I think it's not for everybody, in neither a good way nor a bad way. There's a certain kind of personality type that thrives more in that environment. And it's difficult because obviously publishing is constantly changing and shifting as the world changes and shifts. So to be constantly keeping up with it as well as needing to kind of keep yourself fed is a really interesting balancing act to perform, for sure.
Wow. Someone once said that, like, an agent, if you're going to have, steady income, or if you're a successful agent, you need to have at least like a few dozen writers who are writing to be able to, I guess, get to that point. Is that... I mean, if you don't have your one big writer, is that so that you've got to have like a bunch of writers that
you're repping? It really depends. You know, I mean, obviously some agents only need one author. You know, authors are big enough they make so much money that you're good to go with your kind of flagship authors.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the most part, the vast majority of authors, you know, they have a job that isn't writing. You know, it's a nice way to supplement their income.
Yeah.
They get the occasional royalty check. But, you know, they're not making a living writing full time. Some authors are, and that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you definitely need a robust list of clients who are writing regularly and receiving royalties and writing a book a year because, you know, agents don't get paid until authors get paid, which is why it's always great to do podcasts like this and do conferences and conventions or whatever the case may be, because I am always looking to expand my list and hire new authors, you know, because I think there's a really interesting stigma about how, like, authors get so nervous when they pitch agents or meeting agents as if you don't pay me money and I don't want to read your book and sell it for a lot of money because that's everyone's best interest. So if anything, the agent should be worried about the author saying no to them because you have all the control in that respect. And, you know, the financial part of it is just a kind of a small aspect of the agent-author relationship, but it's one that's kind of hard to avoid.
Right. Just a side thing. Did you never think of becoming a writer yourself? You were just like, no, I'm going to pitch the writer. Did you ever think that you were going to write something, or that was never...
So, I guess I use this word very loosely, but I moonlight as a sports writer.
Okay.
I cover the New England Patriots for SB Nation. I do a podcast and I write a lot of articles covering various aspects of the NFL and Patriots football. I have a bunch of ideas for a book that I think might sell, but the problem with being an agent and also a writer and a reader. This is just me personally. I can't speak for anybody else, but if I'm just in and around the book world all day from 8 in the morning till 7, 8 at night, and I clock out, I don't always feel like reading or writing for another 2 or 3 hours. Yeah. I just kind of want to zone out and watch a really crappy movie or something. So it's hard to find that balance between, you know, being immersed in writing and reading all day and also writing and reading for pleasure. It's very important to do right. for market research and to kind of refresh your brain and reset your battery a bit, to kind of read a book just for the hell of it. But it is one of the challenges of my job when you kind of do what you love for a living to separate doing it because you enjoy it and doing it because you have to do it.
Right. Well, how do you keep track of the market when there's always so much out there? How much of it do you actually have to read versus just kind of know about? I don't know if there's like a real percentage number for that, but how do you keep tabs on something like that?
Yeah, it's tough because publishing is interesting. And, you know, the books that are selling right now on shelves that are really hot right now, things that are trending in publishing, all are over in terms of the business side of it, right? Because the books that are coming out right now, they first sold to publishers 18 months ago, right. 2 years ago, maybe. Right. There's such a long lead time for books and publishing. So you really can't ever, for a writer or an agent or whatever, you can't go to a bookstore, see what's popular, and then write to that because that trend is already long gone at that point. So it's really all about kind of keeping ear to the ground on various deals that are made, just doing networking. You know, before the pandemic, I would do a lot of, you know, drinks meetings or lunch meetings or various networking events with editors where you get to know each other and you hear about who's looking for what people are looking to fill in their lists, just kind of keeping your ear to the ground of the industry as a whole. Publishers marketplace, various deals that are being announced, et cetera, and just knowing what agents and editors are selling elsewhere in the industry. At the same time, though, a lot of this is kind of gut feeling. Manuscripts you really like, a book you're excited to work on, things yeah. you really feel has potential. You know, because again, agents work for free until a book sells, and usually there are several months, if not longer, of back and forth editing and revising and tweaking with the author before you submit to the editor. And even then, it may not even sell. So if you think about whatever you do for your own work, you know, if you're not going to get paid anything for 6 months and you still might not get paid at the end of those 6 months, how much do you have to love what you're doing during that 6 month period to really continue doing it? Yeah. And having that kind of passion really translates, I personally find, into sales down the line.
Well, how often is it, or okay, I don't know if there's a rule for this, that you'll pick up a writer and you might not sell anything of theirs till a few years later, even? Because whatever first attracted you to the work, if it's not fitting the market then, or doesn't have the right agent, does that happen often or not necessarily?
Yep. I currently have an author. We are revising her fourth manuscript. Wow. I'm 0 for 3 on her first three. Wow. We're hoping the fourth one's going to hit. I always say all we're doing with these books that don't hit right away is we're just backloading. They're front-loading future work, you know?
Yeah.
You know, not every – I don't know very many authors at all, actually, where the first book they ever write is the book that sells and gets them and breaks them out. Right. You see authors all the time, once they're established and they're doing well, they publish books they wrote 15 years ago that they couldn't sell at the time, you know? Right. So it's never a bad thing to just keep writing, keep plugging away. I know some agents – I can't speak for anybody besides myself, obviously. You kind of have one shot and you're done. But the vast majority of agents I know, especially in the fiction space – will continue to help you build your career and know when it's time to put a book aside and work on something else. Nonfiction is kind of a different beast, which I'm happy to talk about if you'd like, but in fiction especially, you really want to kind of build the author's career and get to the point where they're just churning books out one a year. That's really everybody's goal. The dream author, the dream agent, one book a year, always does well, steadily growing audience, like a well-oiled machine.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
So if you're a writer, do you have to sit and kind of prod your writer sometimes if you feel like they haven't turned up with an idea yet? Like, come on, where's your book for this year? Or most of the writers, they're coming in and they know that this is a job. They got to make it happen.
Yeah, good question. Especially now, it's very difficult because I know that the work-life balance has shifted dramatically over the course of the year with the pandemic. And a lot of writers have kids. They have to worry about schooling and all that good stuff. So when authors, I don't hear from them for a while, I'll never kind of say, hey, where the hell's my manuscript? So I'll just kind of check in, ask how things are going. If they have any ideas they want to bounce around, I'm always happy to kind of, you know, sometimes they'll come to me with, here are three things I'm kind of kicking around in my head. Which one sounds the most interesting or most saleable to you? Mm-hmm. It really depends on the author themselves. Sometimes authors, they're just prolific idea machines. You know, I've authors had the exact opposite problem with, you know, like publishing is a very slow industry. Yeah. Like I said, if I were to sell your book tomorrow, it's not coming out at this point until probably late, maybe mid-2022 at this point, maybe even later.
Wow.
Some authors can write 10 books in that time span. Yeah. And what do you do with them, right? And so sometimes authors are too prolific, some aren't prolific enough. It's really all that balancing act and all about kind of finding the right fit.
This is kind of goes back to talking about the list that you have. Do you usually have like your core and then there's a big, you have kind of a changeover of like authors who kind of fall off that they either they stop writing or like they're not producing anymore and the new writers are bringing in, or do you just have to keep growing your list, and you could end up with just, you know, 50 authors or however many you're representing?
Yeah, I have authors on my list who I haven't really talked to in a while. We still touch base, but, you know, it's not like where he or she are active in their activity. I have some authors that I'm checking in with all the time. It's weird. Sometimes it's kind of like you kind of just ghost each other, and not a negative way at all. It's just, you just kind of lose touch, and once in a while they'll come out of the woodwork and say, "Hey, all goes well. I'm still working on something." And again, it really depends on the actual author's relationship with the writing. Some right. writers are doing it because it's almost like a hobby; they enjoy it. If they make some money off of it, great. You know, they publish a book once every 4 or 5 years, and that's perfectly fine for them. Some authors are really trying to make a go of it as a career, and you know how invested they are mirrors how invested I am. And, you know, it really is all about that agent-author dynamic in a way that everyone's happy with. So it's kind of all over the place in that respect.
Right. And outside of being in charge, well, I guess so there's two big things that, A, when they give you the manuscript, you got to go back and forth with them with the editing aspect. And then you got to go and pitch it to an agent. And you have to deal, the way writers see agents is how agents see editors. Is that kind of like that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I feel like it's kind of thing where authors are looking around trying to find the right agent for them, and they get a lot of rejections from agents, and they find one that works. Agents spend a lot of time looking for the right editor for their author, and they get a lot of rejections from editors, and then eventually they find one that works. You know, it's a very interesting business. Like, everybody is just constantly getting rejected all the time in this business. You know, authors get turned down by agents, who get turned down by editors, who get turned down by their boss editors, who get turned down by their sales department, who get turned down by like the president of the company. Like, there's always somebody one level up who will kibosh a book deal. And all the stars kind of have to align for everybody, which is why it's so wonderful when it happens.
Yeah, it sounds like, why would anybody get into this industry? Yeah.
No, I mean, again, like, I think any kind of creative industry, you got to be a little nuts to do this. You have to really love it. You know, I mean, you have to. One thing I really appreciate about publishing is that, like, everybody who's in it really genuinely enjoys this business and this industry, because if you don't love it, like, you know, it's not one of those crappy jobs you keep because the money's really good,
right?
Or the benefits are so, you know, it's a job you do because you really, really enjoy it. And there's a very high ceiling. There's always the chance that you could be the one that takes off and becomes a mega overnight success. So there's always that possibility and that hope. And it's also a good community of people in general. Writers are good people for the most part.
Yeah, I think almost every writer I've spoken to so far, I'm like, you are good people. How come everyone doesn't know about you? Yeah. Well, so outside of the actual book pitching, editing, and things like that, do you also sort of act as, how do I say, a career manager? Are you also responsible for helping to book events and things like that, or authors got to find that on their own?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm finding it. I've been in this industry in some capacity, like I said, as an intern from 2008 to right now, and just the role of the agent has just shifted so significantly. I feel like the role of everybody in publishing has shifted so significantly. And one of the harshest surprises that authors learn when they kind of get into the process and have a book deal with a major publisher in place is they are really going to be on the hook for a lot of their own marketing and publicity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the era of the 50-city book tour is a thing of the past, unless your last name is, you know, Grisham or Rowling or something like that. You know, you're doing a lot of your own marketing. You're doing a lot of your own PR. You're hustling your own. And obviously, my job as an agent is to help you with that and to guide you with that and give you advice on how to best maximize your time.
Right.
You know, you don't want to waste your time collecting Twitter followers because those don't really translate. So there are things you can be doing, but obviously the publisher isn't useless. They definitely help you book you interviews and get your reviews and distributions. I'm not saying the publisher can't help you at all, but I always make sure I reiterate the onus of marketing, PR, publicity, pushing your book falls more and more on the author and the agent as the industry continues to evolve.
Only because you mentioned now the Twitter followers, a lot of people, we always, especially with the writers, we're always talking about, oh, you have to be on social media, you have to build your platform, all that kind of stuff. But if you're saying that the Twitter followers don't really translate, so I guess this is for you specifically, do you care if they're on social media, or does that just show engagement no matter how many people, you know, they have following them? Or is that something more important for nonfiction people to have what looks like a platform?
Yeah, it's extremely important for nonfiction. You have to have a platform. The vast majority of nonfiction that sells is platform-based, particularly if it's kind of prescriptive nonfiction. You know, if you're writing a book about infectious disease, for example, like, are you a doctor or a biologist? You have to have, like, why should I listen to you?
Yes.
And here's why. But for fiction, you know, it's nice to have a lot of social media followers, you know, but it's not really necessary. It's good to have the community, people that are supportive, they're going to buy your book. But, you know, it's a much less important thing than for nonfiction. It's more just a matter of being out there, connecting with other writers. You know, you're much more likely, just in general, you're more likely to support somebody you know and you like, right?
Yeah.
You're going to buy their book if you interact with them on a personal basis. It's kind of personal connection. So I always engage authors in fostering those relationships via email newsletters or direct contact or writers groups or whatever the case may be, so you can actually know each other beyond that first main basis, build that community so you have friends, you know. If you have 10,000 Twitter followers and they all love you and they think you're fantastic and they're going to buy your book, that's very different than just kind of collecting 10,000 Twitter followers, 8/10 whom you don't even know. So it's kind of a very different perspective there.
Yeah. I started looking at engagement with social media platforms because sometimes someone can have thousands of followers and you see like 4 people like one of their tweets or something. So I'm like,
right.
So as a general, you know, on a general basis, what does a general day look like for you as an agent? What is kind of if there is such a thing as a normal schedule, what does that kind of look like?
Yeah, so I used to basically spend my commute to and from the office reading new submissions, reading manuscripts, various levels of submissions. That was kind of my time I dedicated every single day, no matter what, to new authors in some capacity. That's gone now, so I lost my commute. So my day's kind of shifted. Usually I'll wake up, and while I'm having my coffee, I will catch up on the 40 or so emails that came into my inbox overnight from international publishers, or I have some clients in Australia, people that aren't on the kind of Eastern Standard Time. Right. And I'll kind of organize my day that way. There isn't really a – that's kind of the only thing I do every single morning. My days are very different. So some days I have to really crash read and edit a manuscript to go on submission with to an editor. Sometimes there's some permissions I have to deal with. Sometimes I'm working on finalizing, negotiating a contract with a publisher. So every day is very different in that respect. And what's really hard for me now I'm finding a harder time breaking down kind of the headspace necessary to really delve into a new manuscript and give it the time and attention and respect it deserves. And I don't really have little pockets of time carved out of my day automatically anymore.
Right.
You know, I'm not waiting in line for my burger at lunchtime.
Right.
You know, so I can read books. So it's really been about trying to find that balance and put on pants. I don't put on pants most days now. And I found it's amazing how much more productive I get when I'm wearing pants. So I've taken to wearing pants a lot more often now. I probably shouldn't say that on this podcast, not professionally, but I'll let you behind the curtain a little bit.
Yeah. Well, that's working from home. I learned that you have to get dressed to say it's going to be a day today. You know,
you do.
Yeah, that's well. If you're reading a manuscript, you know, waiting in line for your burger on the commute. So, are you a speed reader? Do you have to be a speed reader, or you just kind of know? You kind of get a feel for something right away of like, I don't know if I'm going to like this story, but I can see it's good writing or what.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of very – some things you can tell right away. The writing's just not there, or this plot doesn't sound like something I'm very interested in. It's not really my cup of tea, not my wheelhouse. Sometimes you can know right away. Sometimes you read to the end and you're not really sure. Sometimes I've read the whole thing. It really depends on kind of just the gut reaction and how much you really fall in love with the manuscript. Like I said, it's kind of thing where do I believe in this enough? Do I like this enough to work for free on it for at least a couple of months, possibly longer, with no guarantee that anything's going to come out of it? And however long that takes me really varies by author to author. I can speed it if I have to,
right.
But I really prefer when I'm reading a manuscript, when I'm thinking about it for possible representation, to really make sure I give it the time of day. And I read it as a reader first. So what will happen is if I read a book, I really try to – one of the key elements is if a manuscript makes me forget that I'm reading and I'm just like there with it,
yeah,
that's usually a pretty good sign. If I'm ever cognizant, okay, I am currently doing work by reading this manuscript – that's not the kind of connection I need to have. So it's really hard to answer that accurately because it really depends on the book itself.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And well, okay, I guess this has probably changed. This is obviously only true for Writer's House, but Writer's House, it's kind of a bigger name of agency. And it's also, you have a little bit more agents within the actual, agency. Do you, like, how much is there a lot of crossover between agents? Is it something that, you know, the whoever's repping younger readers has what to do with each other? Like, what's the kind of dynamic for that? Because even as small as the book industry is, it seems like people who represent adult are part of the adult world. People who represent younger readers are part of the younger reader world. Or being part of an agency means that you know, everyone's talking to each other and What's going on with you guys? What's going on with you guys? Does that make sense? That became a long question.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's, and one of the things I actually love about Writer's House is as you mentioned, such like a successful agency, and there are a lot of agents there, but everyone there is just absolutely wonderful. It's a really great community. Everyone's very approachable and helpful. And while it's weird, like each agent kind of is his or her own like individual little one-person shop with their own list. There's a lot of collaboration. A lot of times authors will get passed. Like, I'll read something. Hey, it's not quite right for me. I know an agent here who might be great for it. I'll give the manager to that person. You know, we're always kind of bouncing ideas of each other. If I ever run into a problem or something I've never encountered before as an agent, there is decades and decades of experience somewhere within the community of Writer's House. Yeah. And, you know, everyone kind of has their own niche here. You know, not everyone is the exact same. And everyone, you know, I know this person, I kind of just carved a niche as like a sports and books for boys and horror novels. And just because like that's what I like to read. And that was kind of missing from Writer's House. So while everyone is kind of their own individual person, there's such a fostering and supportive community there that I never feel like I'm out on a limb of my own, which is really nice.
Yeah. So does it work that you have total free reign to build the stuff that you're looking for, so then you find the agency that, hey, like, you guys don't have this, so this is what I can bring to the table? Or does it work the other way, that the agency is like, okay, what have you got? No, we don't need any more of this. Take this off your wish list. Like, do they ever interfere with what your wish list looks like, or you get to do what you're going to do?
Yeah, I mean, every agent is pretty much free. I think this is true mostly across the board. Again, Writer's House is my one and only publishing job, so I can't speak to anything that happens outside of my beautiful little bubble.
Yeah.
But at Writer's House, every agent is free to take on whoever and whatever they feel would be the most benefit to themselves and the agency that would sell well. Right. I could definitely foresee scenarios if maybe, hypothetically, there was an author or a personality in the current media that may be a little more controversial.
Yeah.
That might possibly bring negative attention to the agency. If you signed that person or didn't sign that person, that might be a conversation to have. Like, hey, listen, I'm thinking about taking this person on. They have a story to tell, but there may be some blowback. That's something to think about. But in general, if it's like a good book and a good story and a good author, there's not really any kind of restriction in terms of how you can and can't represent something.
In general, what are the things, either that, like, it's a they're always on your list, or like certain kind of stories that you're always a sucker for? Like, what would some of those things be?
Yeah, again, I'm always looking for great horror. I love horror. I grew up on it, like I mentioned earlier, Stephen King and my mom. And it's always been my first love. So I will never shy away from good horror, particularly horror featuring like new monsters or ghost stories from different cultures. I think there are a bunch of different kind of cultures and ethnicities and people out there with their own legends and ghost stories and monsters that go beyond vampires and werewolves. So I'd always love to learn about a new thing to be scared of. I think that's fantastic. I'm a very big supporter of military history, military memoir, especially World War II right now. You know, we're at the point in our timeline where veterans of World War II, they're in their 90s and they're starting to pass away. They're getting about 500 a day right now is the statistic. So wow. I'd love to help preserve any kind of World War II stories that haven't been told yet, which is hard because it's already been told a lot of them. But any kind of new World War II, any kind of military memoir that's unique, especially featuring women in the military. I'd love to do, like, as women become more and more involved in the military, I'd love to do something like that. And I've always been very passionate as a former young boy. I've always been passionate about kind of increasing young male literacy, providing more content for young boys to read again. You know, I always joke that if I ever had a teenage son or a son, he's like, hey, dad, where's a great place to go and meet a nice girl? I'd say the young adult section at bookstores.
Yep.
it's literally an entire floor of books geared towards females. And so I think boys deserve great books as well. And championing kind of young male literacy is very important to me. So if you have any kind of boy-centric books, that's all me for sure.
Yeah, so it's actually interesting that you said that, because I've seen stuff about, getting more women into writing or things like that. But I've always felt, especially that I'm reading so much young adult, I feel like 90% of the writers that I'm reading are female writers with female protagonists. So I was like, did I miss something in the, unless they're talking about in other areas of writing that I didn't tune into, but it seems like young adult is very much dominated by women right now.
It is, you know, I mean, obviously publishing industry is a business. They have to make money. And just, you know, statistically, you know, women read more than men do across the age group. But it might be a cycle where, you know, women are reading more because there are more books for them, and so they read them more. And you know, so again, I don't know. And also, as interesting and meaningful conversations are happening right now about kind of gender and gender identity and how to best include everybody that's possible, I think the more great stories we can have out there, the better off it is for everybody.
Right.
So, you know, and every single conference I go to, every time I talk to somebody, I always hear some version of either I'm a parent of young boys, or I'm a teacher and I have boys in my classroom and I see what's happening to them, what's not happening to them. And I wrote this book with them in mind. So there obviously is a need for it. It's just how to best balance the industry side of publishing with the kind of need for it in on the shelves.
Right. This is something that I saw growing up, so I don't know if it's true or if it's just my own experience, but I feel like some of the boys that I knew were readers, they went from reading, you know, kind of the middle grade, and they skipped over to fantasy, like adult fantasy, without
100%.
Without going through the young adult section. So
yes, boys tend to read up. You know, if you're a 16-year-old boy, for example, you know, you tend to read adult novels for sure. So it's like boy YA really is a sweet spot. It's out there, it exists, but it's very, very hard to do. Middle grade, much less so. I think a fun middle grade ghost story, adventure story. And again, this isn't just because I'm saying the word boy book doesn't mean like it's only for boys or only for girls. Right. I think this just means, I think it's a cool story that can also appeal to boys as well. And as we kind of grow up with new generations, like what exactly appeals to boys and girls is also changing. So
that's
kind of
true.
Being up to speed on those conversations and that dynamic is also important for authors writing towards kids, knowing what kids are into these days, because gone are the days where boys are into X and girls are into Y. And there's much more crossover and common interest, which is wonderful. So finding ways to appeal to both genders is really important.
Right. So all the things that you listed between the horror and things like that, that's all specifically for younger readers, or do you represent for adult also?
Nope. Adult as well. Again, people kind of joke is that, you know, the juvenile stuff's actually probably the slight minority of my list.
Okay.
To put it all in a very simple way, it's like I represent the books you give to your dad on Father's Day. Anything you'd give to your dad on Father's Day is probably an Alex Shane book. Again, sports, biography, history, thriller, mystery, horror, pop culture, pop politics, pop science, some how-to, some business, stuff like that. And then again, like, you know, juvenile adventure, ghost stories, horror stories, and general shenanigans.
Right. And sports is specifically nonfiction, or can be fiction also?
I do fiction as well. I think sports fiction is very difficult.
Yeah,
honestly, sports nonfiction is also very difficult. You know, the intersection of sports fans and readers isn't that big.
Yes.
And a lot of people who are big sports readers, they're fans of a specific team. So, you know, people who are, say, you know, Chicago Bears fans will read a Chicago Bears book. But if you live in Florida, you're probably not going to like the Bears as much. So it's very hard to find those kind of big story, big sports books. So a lot of the sports fiction, or sports nonfiction I do, excuse me, is a little more regional or have kind of a national conversation surrounding them.
Oh, so that's, if it's regional, does that mean that you're working with either a smaller publisher or a much smaller market then? Because I don't know how big it is.
So for example, in 2016, for example, when the my beloved New England Patriots won the Super Bowl over the Atlanta Falcons, that was such an amazing season, but also an amazing year. Like 2016 was an absolutely wild year in American culture, history, politics, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
There was the Deflategate. If you're familiar, there was Tom Brady with his Deflategate suspension. It was the 2016 election was going on, and there was the whole kind of like all that was happening.
Yeah.
And then there was the Atlanta Falcons big comeback. And so that was that was a much bigger story than just one particular team's sports season.
Right.
So I was able to sell that to St. Martin's, which is a big publisher.
Wow, yeah.
However, I've also done some kind of smaller, more regional that are with the kind of University of New England Press or, you know, Triumph Books or some stuff like that. So it really depends on whether the sport itself is the focus of the book, or if there's like a bigger kind of connection to it in the American cultural space.
Right. So if we can find a story of an athlete who becomes a soldier, then we're sold. We got you as an agent.
Yeah. Another great example is it'll be out by the time this podcast airs, most likely. I'm not sure, but on March 2nd, I have a middle grade nonfiction. It's the biography of Glenn Burke. Comes out with Philomel. He was the first ever openly gay athlete across any of the four major sports. He played for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
The high five.
Invented the high five. Yes, invented the high five as well. First guy ever to create with the high five. So that's a great example of kind of the intersection of like social justice or history and culture and sports that I'm really proud of. So something like that would be fantastic for me.
Just as a side thing, when Frank Dufort came out with his autobiography, he kind of puts in like as a comment there that a lot of people don't necessarily like see sports writing as like actual writing. So, I mean, he's someone who's an incredibly lyrical writer. But he was kind of saying that like when awards go out for writers, they don't necessarily look at sports writers or actual writers. Do you see anything like that, if that's true, that when people are writing sports nonfiction, the kind of larger world sees it as like, oh, that's its own thing? Or what? Or do you see that, like, no, writers, all writers kind of respect each other, and, like, it doesn't matter what you're writing about?
Yeah, I mean, I think sports writing will, I will put sports writing with every category. I think there are some absolutely wonderfully talented sports writers who do amazing work and really delve in deeply into the conflicts surrounding it and the various elements of sports and life. And there's some absolute hacks out there who just churn out crap.
Right.
You know, that goes for music, that goes for fiction, nonfiction. I think there's good and bad writers across every field. And, you know, if one thing I like about, you know, respect is it's usually earned, not just granted. And so I will say, I think in general, it can be harder for sports writers to break out because sports is such a specific entity.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to kind of ignore sports versus, like, politics or news.
Right.
But I think sports writers are fantastic and they do some great work.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you don't necessarily see them listed for prizes and stuff like that, but maybe maybe just for sports prizes then. Yeah. But so what? There's a lot of people who don't get the awards. Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, cool. Well, I think I could go on and on, but we got to wrap up just to keep the time under things. So we always wrap up with our fill in the blank of, I love it when writers, editors, agents, you know, publishers, books do X, and I really don't like it when they do X. How would you fill in the blank for those?
Well, man, I really love it. I think I might have already said this, and I'm going to reiterate it here because it's just very true. I love it when a book makes me forget what I do for a living.
Yeah.
I think that is always the key. Whenever I'm aware that I'm reading as an agent versus I'm just reading because I'm engrossed in this story in some capacity, it's just a wonderfully cool feeling. It's just really, really enjoyable. And to the flip side, I hate it when authors in general write something because they feel like they should, and not because they want to. I think that happens, unfortunately, more often than I'd like it to. If you're not in love with your story, odds are I won't be either. And so don't write ever because you feel like you have to write this book, feel like you want to write this book and you need to write this book.
Amazing. Amen. That's also going to go. That's going to be our other magnet that we make from this. All right. Well, Al, thank you so much for joining us. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
This was a bonus episode of Oh My Word podcast featuring agent Alec Shane. To find out more about Alec and whatever he's up to, look at the link in the episode notes. To keep track of Oh My Word podcast of all the great stuff we're up to, check us out on Instagram at Oh My Word podcast or go to eltenenbaum.com. Subscribe, like, tell all your peoples about it. Thanks so much for joining us. Catch you next time.